Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spark Radio Show, filled with strategies, possibilities, actions, resources, and knowledge that may be the spark of a better solution to ignite a positive change in your life. The number to call if you have questions for Melanie or any of our guests is area code 347-215-8390. Now, here's your host, Ms. Melanie.
I think my stop button on my switchboard does not want to work, so the fire's going to crackle along until it runs out. Oh, there we go. Welcome to Spark Radio, or welcome back. I am your host, Ms. Melanie, and I want to thank you so much for investing some of the valuable minutes of your life to spend with me in search of that spark to ignite a positive change in your life. I am so excited to have back on Spark Mark Miller. Our last conversation was about his book, The Secret of Teams, and I'm very excited about his newest book, The Heart of Leadership. And rather than me talking about Mark, I am going to let him share his story and let you know what he is inspired to share with you right now. Thank you so much for being here, Mark, and welcome to Spark.
Well, thank you, Melanie. It's great to be back with you. When people ask me to introduce myself, it's actually pretty simple. I'm a guy who sells chicken for a living. And when pressed, I say, well, that's not totally true because I just try to serve other people who are selling chicken. I've been on the corporate staff at Chick-fil-A now for 35 years. I had the privilege to join the organization as the 16th team member. I started working in the warehouse and the mailroom, and that was after a short career in one of the restaurants, but I was actually not good in the restaurant, and so I managed to get out of there before they fired me and joined the corporate staff, and it has been an incredible ride ever since, and I've actually had trouble holding down a job over all those years. I've worked all across the business, corporate communications, quality and customer satisfaction, field operations, training and development, and so forth and so on. Today, I'm leading a team of internal consultants. We call our group Organizational Effectiveness. And one of the things we're trying to do is figure out how we can scale the business and perhaps even double the size of the business in the next 7 or 8 years. So we're excited about that as we cross the $5 billion threshold, or will this year. So that's some of what I do at the office. When I'm not working, I'm a husband and father and accidental author, thanks to folks like you that help promote the work that I'm doing. And I just love to serve leaders any way, shape, or form that I can. I do that domestically. I do that internationally through my writing and speaking. And it's just a joy to see other leaders grow and flourish.
That is an amazing brief story of the journey that's allowed you to grow to the person you are. And I do want to touch a little bit about your accidental author comment. Can you explain a little bit about becoming an accidental author?
Sure. About 12 years ago, we realized at Chick-fil-A that our system or our process for leadership development had a few cracks in it. And I even use that term graciously because our process prior to the year 2000 was pretty much immersion and osmosis. And, you know, at a certain scope and scale, I think that actually can work. That's the way I was introduced to leadership, but I sat around the table with Truett Cathy, our founder, and our chief financial officer, and our president, because we had lunch together every day. And the deal was, young leaders, emerging leaders, you better pay attention. And I and others, you know, cut our teeth and were indoctrinated to leadership that way. But by the time we got to the year 2000, we had a leadership crisis, lowercase c, but the way it worked is we had opportunities. We turned to look to our leadership bench and didn't have anybody who was ready. And we decided that we needed to accelerate leadership development. And I got the call to try and work on that, and I did what you and I'm assuming many of your listeners would do if given such an opportunity. I put together a team of really smart people, and I said, hey, guess what we get to figure out? You know, we get to figure out how to accelerate leadership development at Chick-fil-A. We concluded pretty quickly that we needed a point of view on what leadership means at Chick-fil-A. We discovered there were over 6,000 published definitions of leadership. And so, to fast forward, we went through a very, very lengthy process, months and months turned into years, trying to figure this out. Now, when I tell folks what we discovered, they go, how long did that take? And I said, yeah, but remember, we sell chicken. You know, this was not our area of expertise. We all had our day jobs. This was kind of an extra project for us. But we worked and worked and worked, and we created what is today known as the SERVE model of leadership. And we shared that with thought leaders because we had a crisis of confidence, to tell you the truth. After we created it, we said, what if this isn't right? And I was actually going to be with Ken Blanchard the very next day after we had that meeting. And the team said, why don't you show this to Ken? And I did. You know, I said, Ken, we've been trying to accelerate leadership development. Here's a point of view that we've created. We'd like you to take a look at it. Tell us if you think it's true. Do you think it's valid? Do you think it'll stand the test of time? And did we miss anything? And I don't know if you or any of your listeners know Ken Blanchard, but he's everybody's favorite grandfather, you know, very gregarious, outspoken. And when he looked at these five bullet points we had on a sheet of paper, he said, this has got to be a book. And I blew him off. I said, Ken, everything looks like a book to you, which is why he sold 50, 60 million books. I said, we don't want to write a book. We don't want to write a book. We're just trying to get you and others to tell us that we got this close before we put a stake in the ground and send our organization into the future pursuing this definition of leadership. And he said, you don't understand. He said, what you're trying to do is to articulate what great leaders do at Chick-fil-A. He said, what you've done is you've articulated what great leaders have done throughout history, and it has to be a book. And one thing led to another. He persisted, and we did a book called The Secret. And The Secret is Great Leaders Serve. The book outlines five strategic ways that great leaders serve, and they always have, and we think they always will. So that's how I got into the writing business. And since then, Chick-fil-A has asked me to do a couple of books. Ken and I did another one. I've got a future one in the works, and so it was never part of my life plan. People often ask me if I enjoy writing, and I tell them I enjoy having written and enjoy the opportunity to serve leaders in that fashion. But it never was something I sought, but it's been a fun journey.
Well, I'm so glad that you did become an accidental author, because the concepts that you have shared in your books are very powerful concepts. And they're a very pleasurable read as well. And they're short. And,
well, thanks.
So, as many of us are so busy we have a 700-page book.
That's all by design. I mean, part of it's by design. The fact they're simple, people ask me, why do you write your books on a sixth-grade level? I said, because that's the best I can do. So the language is just, that's what I'm capable of. But the length is something that Ken challenged me on years ago, and of course he pioneered, I think, the short form leadership parable with the 1 minute manager decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
But he challenged me. He said, if you've got 200 pages, you got two books. You don't want to sell books that people aren't going to read. You want to provide books that people are going to read. And if you write a short book, the chances go up that they're going to read it. And so one quick side story for any aspiring authors out there. When Ken and I decided to do the book, when I agreed to do the book, I said, you know, how do we start? He said, we got two options. He said, you can do the first draft, or we can bring somebody in to help us do the first draft, because he was at a point in his career when, you know, he'd be very active in the project, but he would not do the first draft, which is great. And so I thought about it for a few days, and I said, you know, Ken, I don't know if I've got one book in me or a dozen, but I think I'd like to do the first draft, and as opposed to letting, you know, somebody else do it. He said, great. And so I did the first draft, and sent it to him. Took several months, sent it to him, and he called me and said, well, congratulations, you know, as enthusiastically as you would imagine, you know, hardest part, great job. He says, only one problem. I said, what's that? He said, I don't like it. I said, okay. I said, you're not going to hurt my feelings. I sell chicken for a living. I said, what do we do now? He said, well, we may have to bring in somebody else to help with the story. I said, great. I said, but before we do, tell me what you don't like about it. He said, well, it reminds me of my early work. Thank you very much. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I had to make a decision. And so I chose to pattern it after your early work because the last time I checked, it was selling better than your more recent work. It got real quiet on the phone. And he said, send me 30 copies of that. And so I went down to Kinko's, made 30 copies, sent them to him. Didn't hear anything for 3 months. And he called me back and he said, congratulations. We're not going to change a thing. I said, really? I said, what happened? He said, well, I shared the manuscript with people, and they love it. I said, really? I said, what do they like about it? And he said, they tell me it reminds them of my early work. And then he said, are you ready to do the second draft? And I said, sure. And so he began to talk about elongating the story. He said it unfolds too quickly. So he said, let's add 6 months. So I sent him a draft back where I'd added 6 months, but I'd also added 50 pages of content. So the manuscript went from 125 pages to 175 pages. So he called me back and says, congratulations. He said, you ready to do the third draft? So I said, sure. He said, take out 50 pages. So to any aspiring authors out, I've just become convinced that if we can say it simply and succinctly, we've got a greater chance of gaining an audience. And Ken has mastered that. He's been a wonderful partner, co-author, and mentor for me now for well over a decade.
That is a wonderful story to share. It illustrates so many points around writing and drafts and that so important concept about making it readable. And
yeah.
The fact that you use that fable story model where you can actually have people and relationships and experiences at learning the process rather than just listening, here are the 5 key points, and
well,
going from there.
Yeah, I want to be careful not to project, but I tell you what happens for me when I read a parable. I see myself in the story. Now, maybe not in every character, maybe not in every sentence or in every line, but I'm more likely to see myself in the story. It's easier for me to internalize content when it's presented in the context of a story as opposed to when it's presented in more of an academic or theoretical fashion. So I'm assuming others feel the same way, which would explain why not only Ken's books, but Pat Lencioni's books and others have gotten some traction in recent years.
Yes, we are. Our brains love stories. We think in stories. We learn in stories. And somewhere along the line, when we got into the teaching training mode, we forgot that. It became very academic and very factual. So you're engaging so many different areas of the brain and the processing in the way those stories are written. And I would tend to agree that we can relate in those stories and relate it to our lives in a much deeper way when it's written as a parable or a fable. So let's talk about the heart of leadership. And there's some interesting things I noticed when I read it that I'm excited to be able to ask you about. But before we get there, what led you to this concept of the heart of leadership?
Well, it's a story that really began more than 10 years ago. Because when Ken and I did that first book, we introduced a metaphor of an iceberg. And we said that it's the perfect picture of leadership because about 10% of the iceberg is above the waterline. And it's there for everyone to see. And about 90% is below the waterline. And we said, as you think about leadership, about 10% of our leadership are the skills that others can see. And about 90% of leadership is our leadership character. But that first book was just about the skills. The subtitle of that book was, what great leaders know and do. So it was about the hands of the leader. We made that decision corporately when we created that model because we made the strategic decision that we would select for character and train for skills. And so this was really a field guide of sorts for men and women with leadership character on how do you realize your full potential. You've got to be able to execute and do the things that leaders do. You've got to be able to see and shape the future. You've got to be able to engage and develop others. You've got to be able to reinvent continuously, et cetera. Well, almost immediately, we began to get pushback that people thought the book had value. You know, the book's now in 29 languages, and we've sold probably 500,000 copies. So the book's done okay, but we heard so many voices almost immediately, even when the book was still in draft form, that we had ignored the most important part of leadership. And people have been asking for more than a decade, let's talk about what's most important in leadership. Let's talk about the rest of the story. Let's talk about what's below the waterline. And that's leadership character. It's what really, at the end of the day, determines our success or failure as a leader. Very few leaders I know fail for lack of skills. Now, it happens from time to time, but skills really are too easy to learn. Most of the leaders I know that stumble and fall are those that have issues with their heart. They've got leadership character issues. So this is an idea that's been in conversation and been brewing for more than a decade.
So then let's move into those that you've chosen to focus on in the heart of leadership that can help people become a leader people want to follow versus people have to follow, which I love that subtitle. And so
right.
In the heart of leadership, we revisit Debbie, and I remember Debbie Brewster from the Secret of Teams discussion that we had, and she's,
yes, she's
in this
been in
story
all four
as
books.
Well.
Yes, she's been in all four of the books.
And so tell us a little bit about the framework for the story and the characters in
okay.
the story.
Okay, be delighted to do that. In the last book, Great Leaders Grow, Debbie was mentoring a young man named Blake. And Blake was trying to decide if he could, in fact, be a leader. He had been told he could be a leader, but he was not convinced. And so she sent him on a path of personal discovery built on the premise that your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead. And so in that book, he learned four strategies for learning how to lead. This book picks up 5 years later. Blake passed over for two promotions, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. Well, what he discovers as the story unfolds is that his issue is not a skill gap. He has, in fact, learned how to do the things that leaders do, but he's got heart issues, and people don't want to follow it. So that's the overarching structure of the book. And for him to discover what he needs to learn and what he needs to do to get his heart right, he ends up visiting men and women who actually were part of a small group with his late father, who, by the way, was Jeff Brown from the first book who mentored Debbie. And so he visits these men and women, and they begin to share with him what they've learned about leadership character. And again, the twist is they all learned it from his father. So that's the framework for the story and for the book. An interesting thing happened in one of my meetings with the publisher before we jump into the actual leadership character traits. It was one of those moments where you wonder if there's a hidden camera. I know you've probably had some of those in your life. And the president of the publishing company began to explain to me that people really don't read books anymore. I'm sitting there with the publishing team talking about the launch of this book, and he's talking about people don't read books anymore. And I'm sitting there wondering, where is this going? And I pushed back just a little bit, and he said, well, we've discovered that if they do read books, they don't read the whole book. They read part of it. Very few people finish a book. And I'm going, okay, I'm still not sure where this is going. Remember, I sell chicken for a living, so I'm going, I don't know why you're telling me this, but, you know, I guess there's a lesson here. And he said, there is a lesson here. He said, because people aren't generally going to finish a book, you have to put the good stuff in the front. And I said, well, I tried to edit out all the bad stuff. And he said, yeah, but you outlined 5 leadership character traits in this book, I said, which was encouraging because that, you know, he had read the book. Yes, there are 5 leadership character traits in there. And he said, which one's most important? And I said, well, they're all important. He said, yes, but which one's most important? And I said, I do believe that one of the leadership character traits is first among equals. And he said, which one is that? I said, it's the ability to think others first. He said, then that has to be the first character trait that you talk about in the book. Because if people get nothing other than that, they'll have gotten their money's worth out of this book. That when you and I can cultivate the ability, because this is not normal and natural for many people. There are probably some. But for most of us, it's really hard for our first thought and our first instinct is I'm going to think others first. But those are the men and women that we want to follow. And I hope that all of your listeners have had an experience to work with that type of leader. And I hope that many of your listeners are that type of leader or will become that type of leader. Because when you know somebody really wants you to win, when they really have your best interest at heart, when they think about you before they think about themselves, that is a powerful platform on which to build our leadership. So that's the first trait we talk about in the book.
Well, and that also addresses part of that question I had, which was the sequence of the traits. Because the
aha
connects with the title comes later in the book.
Yes. Yes.
So is there any particular strategy around the sequencing of the other traits?
No. Because I think they're all critical. They're all essential. I think the more you have, the stronger your heart will be, the stronger your leadership character will be. Now, I will say this, though. One of the other traits is to respond with courage. And I probably, if pushed, could have said that's first. You know, you might even could argue that all of them could be first. But I don't know anyone who leads well that is not courageous. Everything we do as a leader requires courage. Sometimes a little bit, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes huge amounts of courage. When you think about casting a bold vision, well, that takes courage. Or determining a strategy or a course of action for our team or our business, that takes courage. Or dealing with difficult people, making hard people decisions, that requires courage. And you can just go on and on and on and on and on and on. You know, allocating money to research and development, allocating money to training, education, and development. Man, that's a courageous stance because the payout is not going to be next week or next month on those investments. And you just go, you just think about so many things that leaders do. So, again, I could probably argue that all of them could be first because they're all essential. I started this activity, by the way, with 33 leadership character traits, as I recall, maybe 34, 32. I thought, John Maxwell's a friend of mine, and I said, John's the only guy I know who can do the 21 irrefutable laws. I said, I don't think I can do the 33, essential leadership character traits. And so there are just a lot of things that form us and mark our leadership. But I worked really hard over the process of several years trying to say, which ones go to the top? What are the critical few? And these are the five. Again, it's not intended to be definitive nor exhaustive, but if you and I can get these five, we will be so far down the road. If we get these five, people will want to follow us. And then if you learn the skills, the requisite skills, you still have to – the top 10% of the iceberg still matters. I told the group this week, think about it as you think about your doctor or your lawyer or your accountant. Do you want them to be men and women of integrity and leadership character? Certainly you do. But you also want them to have the skills to execute on what the job requires. So leaders still have to learn the skills. But if their heart's not right, no one cares about the skills. Performance is actually dismissed. I've seen it happen where you'll have someone who performs and you don't give them the benefit of the doubt. You don't even give them credit for it as it accrues to their leadership account, because if their heart's not right, you just discount the performance. You discount the achievement because you can't get past the fact their heart's not right. If we think they're a self-serving leader, people aren't going to want to follow them.
And you answered one of my questions, which was, how did you determine the five, and that you started with 34? So once people have developed and begin to strengthen these five, there are additional character traits that they could add.
I'm probably never going to work on that because I need to get these five. This is going to take the rest of my life.
Well, and that's the other thing. I think that sometimes we have that mindset of it's a checklist. Like, you learn this and check it off, and learn this and check it off.
Yeah. We've got to work on these forever.
Yes, there are going to be challenges.
Right.
One of the things I like about the story is that, well, and you do this in all of the stories, it involves a team of people. So I want to talk a little bit about how that's manifested in your life with having those teams of like-minded or people who believe or are moving the direction you want to go. How has that impacted you personally and professionally?
Well, goodness. We have been on a journey within our organization since the late 80s to understand what makes teams work. Not just what makes them work, but what creates the highest performing teams. And as you and I discussed in a previous interview, that's where the book The Secret of Teams came from. It's, you know, what we've learned over the last 25 years on that topic. But I think it is huge. I mean, I could give you many, many examples. The serve model that we've been talking about, that was a team of very talented, very gifted people. There's no way I would have come up with that on my own. The teams I've led, whether it be in operations or in the quality group or my current team, I'm sold out to the idea that men and women working together will produce better results. You know, none of us is as smart as all of us. I mean, all the old cliches apply. There's just a collective intelligence. There's a collective energy. There's a collective passion. There's a collective commitment that when you put four, five, six like-minded people together and say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to accomplish. This is the goal. I've seen it work scores and hundreds and thousands of times over the last 25 years. We're in the process right now of casting vision for all of our restaurants as it relates to building these teams in their restaurants, because all of our restaurants are independently operated. They're owned corporately, but they're independently operated. So management and leadership practices are at the discretion of that local restaurant operator. And so we're in year six, I guess, of vision casting, you know, and this isn't the first time we've done it over the last 25 years, trying to get more and more of them to say, yeah, this may make sense in my restaurant. And the ones that have embraced it and have figured out how to do it, their results have been phenomenal. Our finance people said they've never had an intervention in the history of our company that had greater impact on performance than in the restaurants that put teams in place. So that's saying a lot in an organization that had double-digit. We've had double-digit sales increases for 40-some-odd years, and the thing that's driven performance more than anything else are the restaurants that have put teams in place. And so teams are just a big part of you know, the way I see the world, because I like things that work. And done well, teams are phenomenal.
Done well is very, very powerful. And I do highly recommend The Secret of Teams book. So if my listeners haven't read it, I suggest that that's another good one to add to your toolbox, resource kit, whatever language you want to use around that.
Thank you for that. But let me give you a quick word about that. Some people in our organization challenged me that that book was useless. So I want to just, in the spirit of full disclosure, I want to tell your audience. Some people said that book was useless. And I said, thank you very much. I worked really hard on that. Tell me why you think it's useless. And they said, it paints a tremendous picture of what this could be, but it doesn't give us enough details. It doesn't provide enough tactics. We need a blueprint. And I said, well, thanks, because it was really intended to be a book to introduce concepts and ideas and paint a picture. It wasn't intended to be a field guide. I mean, it's a 100-page book, right? So what I've done since then is I have created a field guide, and it's actually on my site. People can download it for free, 125-page full-color field guide on a blueprint for creating high-performance teams. And so that no one be confused as they flip through it, it's full of blanks. Well, I wrote the book that I wish I'd had in college, because all the answers are in the back of the book. I left blanks in it, so if people want to use it as a workbook in a teaching session, they could. But I want to be sure people know about that, because if you do read the book, you may catch a vision for what we're talking about, but you may have the same frustration that some of our staff said. We need more specifics and details. And so there's a separate free resource for folks that want to get that.
And I'm so glad you shared that, because that is true, that the book is the concepts. And I think that when we were talking last about that book, you were in development with that resource guide with more
tactics.
Yes,
because I didn't think about it. I mean, I didn't think about it initially. That was not part of the original plan. So we were a little bit late getting that out, but it is available if folks are interested.
Well, and I was very glad I saw it when I was doing the research for our interview. And so I have a note to share it with our team effectiveness group. So,
well, good. And if they want a
hard copy,
I was going to say, if they want a hard copy, they're available. Go to the resource page. But, you know, you have to pay for those. So if you want the free one, just download it off the PDF.
That is one of the things that I've admired about what I've read about you, Mark, and just in the last interview that we did, is that you do truly walk your talk about service, and you have such a generous heart
in
what you share with people. Before we move on, I do want to finish serve, too.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Because you talked about the first three, and then you stopped. So just for those people who are curious about the skills piece before we move into heart,
yes.
Because you talked about see the future, engage and develop.
Yes. Reinvent continuously, value results in relationships, and embody the values. Those are the five strategic practices. One of the things we have to continually communicate is not to confuse service with leadership. Great leaders serve, but service is not leadership. If I wash your car and walk your dog, that's not leadership. I mean, I'm a nice guy to have around. We believe there are strategic ways that great leaders serve. And we think those five is a good place to start.
And I love the acronym idea from my work with training development and the brain principles. Anything that makes things easier and faster to recall makes it stickier learning and more likely to be used, at least because you remember it.
Well, we hope so.
Then let's take a look then at those other traits that you talk about in the Heart of Leadership, because you talked about think others first. And in the book, not only do you identify what these concepts are, you give some specific actions that people can take to develop those. And so if we could, in our about 25 minutes left, to identify those five core traits and at least one or two actions people can take, and then hopefully they'll get the book so they can read the rest.
Okay. Sure. Well, we talked about think others first as being first among equals. If you get that right, it'll be much easier to do these other things because it, at that moment, is no longer about you. And that's a big step for a lot of folks. And for many, it's a step of faith. But great leaders think others first. So if that's not your natural bent, I mentioned that earlier, I'm not sure that's anybody's natural bent. I think we're all born, you know, the first things we say as young children is mine, right? It's mine.
Right.
It's about me. And I'm afraid that's something that's encoded in all of us. But I think we can learn to think others first. One technique, one practice that will help is if you make a decision that you're going to try to add value to every person you meet. Now, that can be in an endless array of forms. It could be the more simple, straightforward encouragement, coaching, feedback, listening, resources, or maybe it's just a smile. The point is not even as much what you do to add value, but if you condition yourself to think about how do I add value to this person, and you do that over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, you can actually reprogram your mind. You can't be thinking about yourself if you're thinking about adding value to someone else. And you won't add value to everybody, but if you ask that question enough, you'll be shocked and amazed, one, how much value you can add to others and how much they will appreciate that. Remember the subtext in this whole thing is becoming a leader people want to follow. If the people you're around get a sense that you, in an authentic and genuine way, want to add value to their life, people will want to hang around you. So that's just one tactic. Under think others first.
Okay. So let's go in the book. Next comes expect the best.
Yes. Yes. Leaders, by and large, are much more optimistic than non-leaders. Now, again, none of these, I wouldn't hold any of these out as universally true. You could probably find an effective leader who's a pessimist somewhere in the world. But that is not the norm. And you think about why that's the case. The role of the leader is to create a future that does not yet exist. We are architects of the future. That's what leaders do. And so if we don't expect the best, what kind of future do you think we would envision? What kind of future do you think we would try and move towards? And who would want to follow us? I'm going to take us to a place that's not nearly as good as today. It's going to cost more, and it's going to smell bad, and it's going to be painful. Y'all want to go with me? No, it's not going to work.
No, thank you.
People want to follow leaders who expect the best, not just about the future. They expect the best as it relates to people. They expect the best as it relates to themselves. They hold themselves to a high standard because they expect the best. Now, this is not to say that they're delusional. We've met those kind of leaders. No, that's not what we're talking about. It's not the rose-colored glasses. It's just folks that say, no, 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 no. We are going to create a better future. And this is one that it actually, as far as what you and I can do, if we don't expect the best, we have got to believe, we have got to convince ourselves that we're going to create the future, or at least we're going to affect it. It's a belief in our ability to make a difference. We've got to convince ourselves of that. Again, any number of ways to do that. Part of it is to look back and look at the things where you have made a difference and use that as encouragement for yourself that, yes, perhaps I can make a difference going forward. Again, if we don't expect the best, people just aren't going to want to follow us. Leaders,
well, and
leaders,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I use this in the book, the illustration, we've all seen it, we may even have used it before. You look at the glass, it's half full of water, and you say, is it half full or half empty, and you're trying to determine if someone's an optimist or a pessimist. Well, the kind of leader I'm talking about says it's completely full. It's just half air and half water. That's
and
the
that's what I was about to share. Yes, I loved that concept because as someone who, I was just reminded of this the other night as I watched a former student community theater production, and he was talking with my son, who is now 12, after the show, and he turned to him and he said, and by the way, I hated your mother when I first met her. And I'm racking my brain going, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, because he was 13 at the time.
Right.
And so I said to him, I said, remind me why you hated me when you first met me. And so he's looking at my son and not me and says, the first time I heard your mother talk, she talked about the power of a positive mental attitude and focusing on what you want in life. And all I wanted to do was tell her to shut up. He said, and I worked with her for 4 years. He said, and I will tell you now that I live my life that way every day.
Right.
And I'm doing the happy dance going, yes, somebody told my son what I've been trying to model for my son, which, you know, mm-hmm. he'll grow up and get, just like Tim did, that you get what you expect. And you have a choice as to what you expect. And
exactly.
It's just some people aren't always ready for, they don't get it the first take until they see it, they experience it with you, which I think is what you're getting at with the heart of leadership. Is that character mm-hmm. part of walking that talk. This is the first time I have ever read The Glass Being Totally Full, Half Air and Half Water. And so that's I'm laughing because I was just about to say that and you told that story. So
yeah.
Expecting the best, yes. Even when things aren't going well. One of the things
that's
that,
right.
in your introduction that I said a wow about was how much you want to grow the business.
Yes,
that's
we
a huge wow. And a big step. And if you don't expect the best to get people to buy into that possibility, it's very challenging. We want this but.
Right. Right. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Henry Ford. Love that quote.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, so which one do you want to talk about next?
Let's go to, we've talked a little bit about respond with courage and that leaders need to do that. What is a tactic or a strategy or a practice that leaders could take to grow that response to courage?
Yeah. What I encourage people to do is to practice taking action, even on the little things. And I believe it's like a muscle, and you can develop the instincts, and you can develop the tendency, and you can develop the practice that when you see an opportunity, when you see a challenge, when you see a problem, you don't wait, you initiate. I mean, that was one of the things that, if this list were longer, initiative is one of the things. So I try to talk about it in this context because leaders generally don't wait. And I think the more we do that, the more we discipline ourselves to the more we will act with courage. Because, again, I believe most of the significant decisions we make require courage, sometimes a little bit, sometimes a lot. I mentioned some earlier, but even another one that comes to mind that I wrestle with all the time is as I attempt to steward my time and manage my calendar, it takes courage to tell people no. You know, everybody has a wonderful plan and agenda for my life. But I've got to figure out what are the organizational priorities? What are my priorities? You know, where do I need to invest my time? So just literally telling somebody who wants me to come to a meeting, I can't come. Or they want me all day and I can come for an hour. Or somebody wants me to speak and I can't speak. Even those little decisions, they require courage. So I believe the way to strengthen that courage muscle within our heart is to become a person of action.
And I appreciate in this section when you're in covering this trait and what Blake realizes and hears is that it's not always that you're going to take the best action, the right action, or have the best results. It's having the courage to take an action.
Right. Right.
That can make
a
difference.
If you wait for the perfect timing, if you wait for the perfect circumstances, you won't act. And if you don't act, you're not going to lead. That's why I say courage is really the catalyst for leadership. I don't know any great leader that doesn't respond with courage. It's the catalyst for leadership.
And with the catalyst being something that accelerates a change.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
It's what puts leadership in motion. Again, leadership is a concept until a leader demonstrates courage, until they respond with courage. Leadership's just an idea.
And there's so much more in the book. And we have about 12 minutes left, and I do want to have time for questions. So I'm going to put the phone number out there now, so if there are people who are listening live who have a question for you, they can get in the queue as we're approaching the end. And that number is 347-215-8390. And we're having some problems with the chat room technologically. So if people do have questions, we invite you to call. And I will say that the majority of my listeners download the podcast later, so that's exciting for me. And the other thing I want to add about courage, because even if it's not in a position that if you're thinking about leading at work, for example, I remember the first times I began to invite authors to these interviews, I thought there's that voice in your head that's like, oh, who are you to even ask? And one of my first guests was someone that I connected with on Twitter and just invited them. I really loved the book and wanted to promote it. And she said yes. And I'm like, okay. And so then moving forward, because what's the worst that can happen? They'll say no. And so having the courage to just put it out there is huge. Let's talk about hunger for wisdom.
Okay. Just quickly, I don't know that there's a formula that I would recommend. One of the tactics I actually like is to create a network of counselors or advisors or your own personal board of directors. In fact, I wrote a blog post on that on September 30th. You know, who helps you make important decisions? But this is really built around the idea that there's an inherent humility when leaders say, I don't know it all. I want to keep learning. I want to keep growing. I think I mentioned that earlier. It's something that Blake learned in the book, Great Leaders Grow. Your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead. And I think those are the type leaders that people want to follow because they're not living off what they learned a decade ago. They're living off of current reality and current learnings and current insights. I just think leaders are learners, and they understand that the speed of the leader, speed of the team. We cannot ask and expect others to learn and grow if we're not willing to do so. People always watch the leader, and they're looking for clues as to what's important, and they're looking to determine if we're trustworthy. And if we say one thing and do another, then we're going to forfeit the opportunity for influence.
Absolutely. And that also circles back to when we're talking about, you know, the power of the network that you have around you, those people who can give you different opinions and different experiences that you have and have that same passion around what you're passionate about, because then they fuel the fire rather than drench it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think I don't remember if it was this, I think it was in this book too, that the concept of we tend to become like the people with whom we associate.
Yes, that is true. That is true. And there's actually research to support that. And I think we could all think about it in our own experience, which is another reason to surround yourself with, you know, the right folks. Choose your friends carefully.
Yes. And the last trait that you highlight in The Heart of Leadership is accept responsibility. What do you mean by accept responsibility?
Yes. Leaders are willing to own the outcome. They're willing to own their actions. They're willing to own the actions and outcomes of others. The psychologists call it a locus of control. It's a belief that my actions are affected and impacted by my decisions, and my decisions affect my actions. It's we're not a victim. We have control, and we're willing to accept responsibility for what happens. Now, the flip side of that, this one's actually a two-sided coin, because the best leaders, although they're willing to accept responsibility, they're also quick to give praise. So if things don't go well, I own it. If things go well, I'm going to find somebody else who touched this, who worked on this, and I'm going to be sure that they get appropriate recognition. So it's a two-sided coin. And you do that, and people know you're not trying to throw them under the bus, but when there's a problem, you're willing to step up and own it. Again, remember, the subtext for this whole book is becoming a leader people want to follow. So somebody on my team drops the ball, and I stand up and say, it's my accountability, it's my issue, I own it, we'll fix it. As opposed to saying, well, Joe did that or Sally did that. They're not going to say that. Tactically, well, I'm going to be the first one to push Joe and Sally to the front of the room. The way we get better at this, I think, is to pretend you own the outcome for every project you touch. How would that change your behavior? How would you think about it? How would you talk about it? How would you behave before, during, and after the project is completed? I think it requires a little mental gymnastics, but you can reframe. Your entire orientation will change. You won't whine. You won't complain. You won't moan. You'll be more constructive. You'll protect others. You'll praise others. Just a little mental exercise. I may just be a member of this team. I may just be a member of this department. I may not be the team leader, but I'm going to pretend I own the outcomes. It'll change your heart.
And that is another good point that you make in the book as well, is that leadership is not a position or a title.
That is correct. If you wait for a position or a title, you may wait forever. We control our readiness. Others control our opportunity. We just need to be ready. My belief is we'll have plenty of opportunities.
And the time to get ready is before the opportunity is there.
Absolutely.
So as we look at developing the heart of leadership, this is the part that I was wondering. You explained it earlier in the interview about why think others first is first. And so the heart of leadership is truly the heart that you talk about in these five traits.
That is
correct.
Going
back to the power of an acronym, yes. How did that come easily to you, or did you reword things so that it fit?
Well, some of both. Again, part of it, I felt like I didn't need to do 21 or 34 or 15 or 18. I didn't need a long list, so I needed a short list. And there's actually an ancient proverb that informed my thinking on this, and it goes like this. Above all else, guard your heart. Everything you do flows from it. So while that's not anatomically and biologically correct, you know, we understand the brain has something to do with it and so forth and so on. If you think of that, if the heart, as the ancients believed, was the seat of all being and emotion, everything you do flows from your heart. Are you trying to serve others? Are you trying to serve yourself? Are you trying to add value to others? Are you trying to add value to yourself? Are you trying to accept responsibility? Are you trying to place blame? And you just go right down the list. I think if we can get our heart right, if you think about the heart as leadership character, I believe that's 90% of the battle we fight as leaders. Ultimately, I think that's what's going to determine our success or failure.
And as we talk about the principles in this book, and for the people who are working on leadership development programs in their companies or curriculum, and they listen to this interview and they say, oh, my gosh, we need to get this in to the program. This is very, very powerful because it's part of that. This is a 90% under the waterline. What are some resources that they could go to include in that curriculum to develop or to help their leaders develop these traits?
Let me give you a quick two-part answer. I know we're about out of time. First of all, I would try to never again select a candidate who did not already have a significant measure of these leadership character attributes. I think selection is where you win or lose, basically. We've got 97% retention of our corporate staff and 97% retention of our restaurant operators, and I think the majority of that can be attributed to selection. So number one, I would say, yeah, you're going to probably have to help some of your existing folks with this, but this is heavy lifting. This is hard to do. Not impossible. If it's impossible, I wouldn't have invested the time to write the book. But it's really challenging in adults. I think it's easier in young people. It's actually a process called parenting. this is what we're trying to instill into our kids. Possible, but much harder with adults. So my first suggestion for HR people in the world is try to select these kind of men and women into your organization. And then once you've got a pool of people in your company and you're looking for men and women to put in positions of leadership, be sure this is part of your internal selection process, your internal criteria. And I've got an assessment on my site, a free assessment, greatleaderserve.org. Under the resource tab, there are assessments to go with all my books. They're free PDFs. Download them if you'd like. And there's some additional behavioral-based questions that you can use for a self-assessment, a team assessment, to assess a candidate, however you want to use it. But I would try to recruit for this. Then to your question of resources, I'm working on a field guide. It'll be available soon. It'll be on the site. It'll be for free, just like the team's guide. Because there are things you can do, but I'm personally not aware of curriculum that aligns with this. And so at this point, I've got no specific recommendation that I can make.
Well, you just gave two very good ones. And just so you know, we're not tied to stopping on the hour. We're okay with going over a couple minutes, because I know there are a couple more questions I'd like to ask you if you have a few minutes.
Okay, great.
I also want to respect your time and make sure you aren't running off to something else, because you are
busy,
and I very much appreciate your willingness to
be with me and with my listeners. So what's a question you wish I would have asked you, Mark, and what is your answer?
A question I wish you had asked, and what is my answer? I think it would be fun to entertain the question, why do some people misunderstand this topic? Here's what I think. When we began to talk about leadership character, many people, even if you ask, this is a fun activity, if you want to do this in a classroom setting, it's kind of fun, write down leadership character attributes. And they're going to say things such as integrity and loyalty and honesty. And at that point, I pretty much stop them. I'm going, whoa. Don't you want that from everybody? And they're going to say, well, of course we do. Well, okay, so that's a prerequisite for your leaders. But those aren't the character traits that differentiate leaders, the traits that set them apart from non-leaders. So I think that's why I'm hoping, and my prayer is that this book would add some value, because I think it's going to change the conversation. Of course you want people with integrity. Of course you want people who are honest and loyal. That doesn't make them leaders. Now, if they don't have those things, they'll disqualify themselves, certainly. But the things we've talked about in this last hour, these are things you see in leaders that you generally don't see in non-leaders. That's why I think this is valuable. Because whether everyone could lead or not, many choose not to. Many choose not to develop these traits. You know, their parents didn't instill it in them, and they've not chosen to go this path. That's fine. That's their prerogative. Just don't put them in charge of anything. So to me, that's a very important distinction, that this book is about what makes leaders different. In fact, that was the working title, months or 9 months for the book, was Leaders Are Different, because they actually are different. And these are five ways that they're different.
Thank you for sharing. That was a great question.
It was. I'm glad you came up with it.
I'm glad we did. The one of the last questions that I have is, and we spoke a little bit before our interview about a new project that you're working on. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yes. And I am excited about it. As we've already covered during this conversation, we've been working for more than two decades on helping our restaurants build high teams, and we're still on that journey, and we're not turning away from that. But as we began several years ago looking at the year 2020, the question was asked, what's after these high performance leadership teams, which has been our focus within the restaurants? What's after high performance leadership teams? And I said, well, if you think about it, what these leadership teams specifically, what they accomplish is they tap into the deep reservoir of talent and passion and energy and engagement of about 5% of our workforce. So what I think next for our organization and for many others is, what do you do to tap in to the energy, the enthusiasm, the passion, and the engagement of the other 95%? And so since we've been focused on high-performance leadership teams, what we're going to focus on next are high-performance organizations. And that work is already underway. We're piloting that now in 30-plus of our restaurants. We did a pretty extensive search of best practices, both within our organization and across the globe, because a lot of other people have thought about this before. And we've tried to put it in a form, in a package that we think will be easy to explain, to communicate, to transfer, and to activate. And so we're in the middle of a pilot right now, and it's our plan to deploy this within our organization 2015, 16, and 17. And so I'm already working to put that in a form that there'll be a book on creating high-performance organizations. Maybe we can talk about that at a future interview.
I was just going to ask if you are interested in coming back again, because I love promoting the work that you do.
Yes, we're really excited about this.
It's definitely exciting because the potential of having high-performance organizations is an amazing possibility that so many organizations would like to achieve and just aren't sure how to go there.
Yeah.
Last question.
We think we know. We'll be excited to share that soon.
Well, and the thing that I value around the work that you share, Mark, is that you've walked it.
Yeah, we're going to be sure it works before we put it in our restaurant. We've got 1,800 restaurants. We're not doing stuff just for fun, and we're not doing stuff just to try it. We're doing stuff to improve performance, and I think that's what most of the world wants to do. Now, as we discussed before, our definition of success is a little broader than many organizations. It's about results, traditional results, and relationships. So, yes, there's a broader definition, but as Truett reminds us all the time, our founder, he said, there is no mission without margin, and we want to be a successful business. And so we're not going to deploy anything that doesn't work.
And that you're willing then to share what you've learned with the world is
maybe it'll help. Maybe it'll help the world. I mean, that's what our executive committee said 12 years ago when we were debating, when Ken wanted us to do this book. Our executive committee said maybe this will help the world. Little did we know, none of us knew, it would end up in 29 languages, you know, a decade later. But I appreciate their vision and foresight and their spirit of generosity. And maybe this will help the world.
And I think it has. My last question, Mark, what are one or two takeaways that you would like those who listen to this interview to walk away from and to take with them?
As a leader, if your heart is not right, no one cares about your skills. We can try to overcome heart issues with performance, and it will never happen. I've seen it too many times. We really do need to become a leader that people want to follow, because that's the essence of leadership.
That is a very, very powerful statement. So on that note, Mark, I thank you so very much for being here. It's been a pleasure to talk with you and to share the story of the heart of leadership. And as you mentioned earlier, people can connect with you at greatleadersserve.org.
Yes, and on Twitter, @leadersserve.
And Mark is a great blog writer and thought-provoking and entertaining. So I encourage you to definitely visit the website. And if you haven't known Mark before now, become acquainted with Mark and his writing and his work. Thanks so much, Mark, for being here. And I do look forward to being with you again and wish you continued success in your work at Chick-fil-A and in making a difference in the world.
Great. Thank you, Melanie.
Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, do take care of the only brain that you have, as well as to grow your heart. Stay safe.
Thank you for listening to Spark Radio with Ms. Melanie. Please share this show link with those you believe would enjoy and benefit from listening. We invite you to join us for upcoming shows with special guests and more sparks. May a spark you heard ignite a positive change in your life. Good day.